He came to your school? The scandalous rodent loaf. Did you draw him? Show me.
Outraged or not, she wouldn't miss an opportunity to see Kaz naked.
Karu pulled out her pad and flipped it open.
You scribbled out the best part,
Issa accused. Trust me, it's not that great. Issa giggled into her hand as the shop door creaked open to admit them, and Karu stepped across the threshold. As always, she felt the slightest wave of nausea at the transition. She was no longer in Prague. Even though she had lived in Brimstone's shop, she still didn't understand where it was, only that you could enter through doorways all over the world and end up right here. As a child, she used to ask Brimstone exactly where here was, only to be told brusquely,
elsewhere.
Brimstone was not a fan of questions. Wherever it was, the shop was a windowless clutter of shelves that looked like some kind of tooth fairy's dumping ground. If, that is, the tooth fairy trafficked in all species. Viper fangs, canines, grooved elephant molars, overgrown orange incisors from exotic jungle rodents. They were all collected in bins and apothecary chests, strung in garlands that draped from hooks, and sealed in hundreds of jars you could shake like maracas. The ceiling was vaulted like a crypt's, and small things scurried in the shadows, their tiny claws scritch-scritching on stone. Like Kishmish, these were creatures of disparate parts. Scorpion mice, gecko crabs, beetle rats. In the damp around the drains were snails with the heads of bullfrogs, and overhead, the ubiquitous moth-winged hummingbirds hurled themselves at lanterns, setting them swaying with the creak of copper chains. In the corner, Twigo was bent over his work, his ungainly long neck bowed like a horseshoe as he cleaned teeth and banded them with gold to be strung onto catgut. A clatter came from the kitchen nook that was Yasri's domain. And off to the left, behind a huge oak desk, was Brimstone himself. Kishmish was perched in his usual place on his master's right horn, and spread out on the desk were trays of teeth and small chests of gems. Brimstone was stringing them into a necklace and did not look up.
Karu, he said, I believe I wrote errand requiring immediate attention.
Which is exactly why I came immediately.
It's been,
he consulted his pocket watch,
40 minutes.
I was across town. If you want me to travel faster, give me wings and I'll race Kishmish back. Or just give me a Gavriel and I'll wish for flight myself. A Gavriel was the second most powerful wish, certainly sufficient to grant the power of flight. Still bent over his work, Brimstone replied,
I think a flying girl would not go unnoticed in your city.
Easily solved, said Karu. Give me 2 Gavriels and I'll wish for invisibility too. Brimstone looked up. His eyes were those of a crocodile, luteous gold with vertical slit pupils, and they were not amused. He would not, Karu knew, give her any Gavriels. She didn't ask out of hope, but because his complaint was so unfair. Hadn't she come running as soon as he'd called?
I could trust you with Gavriels, could I?
He asked. Of course you could. What kind of question is that? She felt his appraisal, as if he were mentally reviewing every wish she'd ever made. Blue hair, frivolous. Erasing pimples, vain. Wishing off the light switch so she didn't have to get out of bed, lazy.
He said, Your necklace is looking quite short. Have you had a busy day?
Her hand flew to cover it. Too late. Why do you have to notice everything? No doubt the old devil somehow knew exactly what she'd use these scuppies for, and was adding it to his mental list, making ex-boyfriend's cranny itch. Vindictive.
Such pettiness is beneath you, Karu.
He deserved it, she replied, forgetting her earlier shame. Like Zuzana had said, bad behavior should be punished. She added, Besides, it's not like you ask your traders what they're going to use their wishes for, and I'm sure they do a hell of a lot worse than make people itch.
I expect you to be better than them, Brimstone said simply.
Are you suggesting that I'm not? The tooth traders who came to the shop were, with few exceptions, about the worst specimens humanity had to offer. Though Brimstone did have a small coterie of long-time associates who did not turn Karoo's stomach, such as the retired diamond dealer who had on a number of occasions posed as her grandmother to enroll her in schools, mostly they were a stinking, soul-dead lot with crescents of gore under their fingernails. They killed and maimed. They carried pliers in their pockets for extracting the teeth of the dead, and sometimes the living. Karoo loathed them, and she was certainly better than them. Brimstone said,
"Prove that you are, by using wishes for good."
Nettled, she asked, "Who are you to talk about good, anyway?" She gestured to the necklace clutched in his huge clawed hands. Crocodile teeth. Those would be from the Somali. Also wolf fangs, horse molars, and hematite beads. I wonder how many animals died in the world today because of you, not to mention people. She heard Issa suck in a surprised breath, and she knew she should shut up, but her mouth kept moving. No, really. You do business with killers, and you don't even have to see the corpses they leave behind. You lurk here like a troll.
Garoo,
Brimstone said. But I've seen them. Piles of dead creatures with bloody mouths. Those girls with their bloody mouths? I'll never forget that as long as I live. What's it all for? What do you do with these teeth? If you would just tell me, maybe I could understand. There must be a reason.
Garoo,
Brimstone said again. He did not say, shut up. He didn't have to. His voice conveyed it clearly enough, on top of which he rose suddenly from his chair. Karoo shut up. Sometimes, maybe most of the time, she forgot to see Brimstone. He was so familiar that when she looked at him, she saw not a beast, but the creature who, for reasons unknown, had raised her from a baby, and not without tenderness. But he could still strike her speechless at times, such as when he used that tone of voice. It slithered like a hiss to the core of her consciousness and opened her eyes to the full, fearsome truth of him. Brimstone was a monster. If he and Issa, Twiga, and Yasri were to stray from the shop, that's what humans would call them. Monsters. Demons, maybe. Or devils. They called themselves Chimera. Brimstone's arms and massive torso were the only human parts of him, though the tough flesh that covered them was more hide than skin. His square pectorals were riven with ancient scar tissue, one nipple entirely obliterated by it, and his shoulders and back were etched in more scars, a network of puckered white cross-hatchings. Below the waist, he became Elsthing. His haunches, covered in faded off-gold fur, rippled with leonine muscle. But instead of the padded paws of a lion, they tapered to wicked, clawed feet that could have been either raptor or lizard, or perhaps, Karoo fancied, dragon. And then there was his head. Roughly that of a ram, it wasn't furred, but fleshed in the same tough brown hide as the rest of him. It gave way to scales around his flat ovine nose and reptilian eyes, and giant yellowed ram horns spiraled on either side of his face. He wore a set of jeweler's lenses on a chain, and their dark gold rims were the only ornament on his person, if you didn't count the other thing he wore around his neck, which had no sparkle to catch the eye. It was just an old wishbone, sitting in the hollow of his throat. Karoo didn't know why he wore it, only that she was forbidden to touch it, which, of course, had always made her long to do so. When she was a baby and he used to rock her on his knee, she would make little lightning grabs for it, but Brimstone was always faster. Karu had never succeeded in laying so much as a fingertip to it. Now that she was grown, she showed more decorum. But she still sometimes found herself itching to reach for the thing. Not now, though. Cowed by Brimstone's abrupt rising, she felt her rebelliousness subside. Taking a step back, she asked in a small voice, So, what about this urgent errand? Where do you need me to go? He tossed her a case filled with colorful banknotes that turned out to be euros. A lot of euros.
Barris, said Brimstone.
Of fun. Chapter 6. The Angel of Extinction. Fun?
Oh, yes,
Karu muttered to herself later that night as she dragged 300 pounds of illegal elephant ivory down the steps of the Paris metro.
This is just so much fun.
When she'd left Brimstone's shop, Issa had let her out through the same door by which she'd entered, but when she stepped onto the street, she was not back in Prague. She was in Paris, just like that. No matter how many times she went through the portal, the thrill never wore off. It opened onto dozens of cities, and Karu had been to them all, on errands like this one, and sometimes for pleasure. Brimstone let her go out and draw anywhere in the world where there wasn't a war, and when she had a craving for mangoes, he opened the door to India, on the condition that she bring some back for him, too. She had even wheedled her way into shopping expeditions to exotic bazaars, and right here to the Paris flea markets to furnish her flat. Wherever she went, when the door closed behind her, its connection to the shop was severed. Whatever magic was at work, it existed in that other place. Elsewhere, as she thought of it, and could not be conjured from this side. No one would ever force his way into the shop. One would only succeed in breaking through an earthly door that didn't lead where he hoped to go. Even Karu was dependent on the whim of Brimstone to admit her. Sometimes he didn't, however much she knocked, though he had never yet stranded her on the far side of an errand, and she hoped he never would. This errand turned out to be a black market auction in a warehouse on the outskirts of Paris. Karu had attended several such, and they were always the same. Cash only, of course, and attended by sundry underworld types like exiled dictators and crime lords with pretensions to culture. The auction items were a mixed salad of stolen museum pieces, a Chagall drawing, the dried uvula of some beheaded saint, a matched set of tusks from a mature African bull elephant. Yes, a matched set of tusks from a mature African bull elephant. Karu sighed when she saw them. Brimstone hadn't told her what she was after, only that she would know it when she saw it. And she did. Oh, and wouldn't they be a delight to wrangle on public transportation? Unlike the other bidders, she didn't have a long black car waiting, or a pair of thug bodyguards to do her heavy lifting. She had only a string of scuppies and her charm, neither of which proved sufficient to persuade a cab driver to hang 17-foot-long elephant tusks out the back of his taxi. So, grumbling, Karu had to drag them 6 blocks to the nearest metro station, down the stairs and through the turnstile. They were wrapped in canvas and duct-taped, and when a street musician lowered his violin to inquire,
"Hey, lovely, what you got there?"
she said, "Musicians who asked questions," and kept on dragging. It could have been worse, certainly, and often was. Brimstone sent her to some god-awful places in pursuit of teeth. After the incident in St. Petersburg, when she was recovering from being shot, she'd demanded, "Is my life really worth so little to you?" As soon as the question was out of her mouth, she'd regretted it. If her life was worth so little to him, she didn't want him to admit it. Brimstone had his faults, but he was all she had for a family, along with Issa and Twiga and Yasri. If she was just some kind of expendable slave girl, she didn't want to know. His answer had neither confirmed nor denied her fear.
Your life. You mean your body. Your body is nothing but an envelope, Garu. Your soul is another matter, and is not, as far as I know, in any immediate danger.
An envelope? She didn't like to think of her body as an envelope, something others might be able to open up and rifle through, remove things from like so many clipped coupons.
I assumed you felt the same way, he'd said, the way you scribble on it.
Brimstone didn't approve of her tattoos, which was funny, since he was responsible for her first, the eyes on her palms. At least, Karu suspected he was, though she didn't know for sure, since he was incapable of answering even the most basic questions. Whatever, she'd said with a pained sigh. Really, pained. Getting shot hurt, no surprise there. Of course, she couldn't argue that Brimstone shoved her unprepared into danger. He'd seen to it that she was trained from a young age in martial arts. She never mentioned it to her friends. It was not, her sensei had taught her early, a bragging matter. And they would have been surprised to learn that Karu's gliding, straight-spined grace went hand-in-hand with deadly skill. Deadly or not, she'd had the misfortune to discover that karate went only so far against guns. She'd healed quickly with the help of a pungent salve, and, she suspected, magic. But her youthful fearlessness had been shaken, and she went on errands with more trepidation now. Her train came, and she wrestled her burden through the doors, trying not to think too much about what was in it, or the magnificent life that had been ended somewhere in Africa, though probably not recently. These tusks were massive, and Karu happened to know that elephant tusks rarely grew so big anymore. Poachers had seen to that. By killing all the biggest bulls, they'd altered the elephant gene pool. It was sickening, and here she was, part of that blood trade, hauling endangered species contraband on the freaking Paris metro. She shut the thought away in a dark room in her mind and stared out the window as the train sped through its black tunnels. She couldn't let herself think about it. Whenever she did, her life felt gore-streaked and nasty. Last semester, when she'd made her wings, she'd dubbed herself the Angel of Extinction, and it was entirely appropriate. The wings were made of real feathers she'd borrowed from Brimstone, hundreds of them, brought to him over the years by traders. She used to play with them when she was little, before she understood that birds had been killed for them, whole species driven extinct. She had been innocent once, a little girl playing with feathers on the floor of a devil's lair. She wasn't innocent now, but she didn't know what to do about it. This was her life, magic and shame and secrets and teeth and a deep nagging hollow at the center of herself where something was most certainly missing. Karu was plagued by the notion that she wasn't whole. She didn't know what this meant, but it was a lifelong feeling, a sensation akin to having forgotten something. She'd tried describing it to Issa once, when she was a girl. It's like you're standing in the kitchen, and you know you went in there for a reason, but you can't think of what that reason is, no matter what. And that's how you feel? Asked Issa, frowning. All the time. Issa had only drawn her close and stroked her hair, then its natural near black, and said unconvincingly, I'm sure it's nothing, lovely. Try not to worry. Right. Well, getting the tusks up the metro steps at her destination was a lot harder than dragging them down had been, and by the top, Karu was exhausted, sweating under her winter coat and extremely peevish. The portal was a couple more blocks away, linked to the doorway of a synagogue's small storage outbuilding, and when she finally reached it, she found two Orthodox rabbis in deep conversation right in front of it. Perfect, she muttered. She continued past them and leaned against an iron gate just out of sight to wait while they discussed some act of vandalism in mystified tones. At last they left, and Carew wrangled the tusks to the little door and knocked. As she always did while waiting at a porthole in some back alley of the world, she imagined being stranded. Sometimes it took long minutes for Issa to open the door, and each and every time, Carew considered the possibility that it might not open. There was always a twinge of fear of being locked out, not just for the night, but forever. The scenario made her hyper-aware of her powerlessness. If someday the door didn't open, she would be alone. The moment stretched, and Carew, leaning wearily against the doorframe, noticed something. She straightened. On the surface of the door was a large black handprint. That wouldn't have been so very strange, except that it gave every appearance of having been burned into the wood. Burned, but in the perfect contours of a hand. This must be what the rabbis were talking about. She traced it with her fingertips, finding that it was actually scored into the wood, so that her own hand fit inside it, though dwarfed by it, and came away dusted with fine ash. She brushed off her fingers, puzzled. What had made the print? A cleverly shaped brand? It sometimes happened that Brimstone's traders left a mark by which to find portals on their next visit, but that was usually just a smear of paint or a knife-gouged X marks the spot. This was a bit sophisticated for them. The door creaked open to Carew's deep relief.
"Did everything go all right?" Issa asked.
Carew heaved the tusks into the vestibule, having to wedge them at an angle to fit them inside. "Sure." She slumped against the wall. "I'd drag tusks across Paris every night if I could. It was such a treat." Chapter 7. Black Handprints. Around the world, over a space of days, black handprints appeared on many doors, each scorched deep into wood or metal. Nairobi, Delhi, St. Petersburg, a handful of other cities. It was a phenomenon. In Cairo, the owner of a shisha den painted over the mark on his back door only to find, hours later, that the handprint had smoldered through the paint and showed just as black as when he'd discovered it. There were some witnesses to the acts of vandalism, but no one believed what they claimed to have seen.
"With his bare hand,"
a child in New York told his mother, pointing out the window.
"He just put his hand there, and it glowed and smoked."
His mother sighed and went back to bed. The boy was an established fibber, worse luck for him, because this time he was not lying. He had seen a tall man lay his hand on the door and scorch the mark into it.
"His shadow was wrong,"
he told his mother's retreating back.
"It didn't match."
A drunken tourist in Bangkok witnessed a similar scene, though this time the handprint was made by a woman of such impossible beauty that he followed her, spellbound, only to see her, as he claimed, fly away.
"She didn't have wings," he told his friends, "but her shadow did."
"His eyes were like fire," said an old man who caught sight of one of the strangers from his rooftop pigeon coop. "Sparks rained down when he flew away."
So it was in slum alleys and dark courtyards in Kuala Lumpur, Istanbul, San Francisco, Paris. Beautiful men and women with distorted shadows came and scorched their handprints onto doors before vanishing skyward, drafts of heat billowing behind them with a woomph of unseen wings. Here and there, feathers fell, and they were like tufts of white fire, disintegrating to ash as soon as they touched the ground. In Delhi, a sister of mercy reached out and caught one on her palm like a raindrop. But unlike a raindrop, it burned and left the perfect outline of a feather seared into her flesh.
"Angel,"
she whispered, relishing the pain. She was not exactly wrong. Chapter 8. Gavriel's. When Carew stepped back into the shop, she found that Brimstone was not alone. A trader sat opposite him, a loathsome American hunter whose slab of meat face was garnished by the biggest, filthiest beard she had ever seen. She turned to Issa and grimaced.
I know,
agreed Issa, coming across the threshold in a ripple of serpentine muscle.
I gave him Avagoth. She's about to molt.
Karu laughed. Avagoth was the coral snake wound around the hunter's thick throat, forming a collar far too beautiful for the likes of him. Her bands of black, yellow, and crimson looked, even in their dulled state, like fine Chinese cloisonne. But for all her beauty, Avagoth was deadly, and never more so than when the itch of impending molt made her peevish. She was wending now in and out of the massive beard, a constant reminder to the trader that he must behave if he hoped to live.
On behalf of the animals of North America, whispered Karu, can't you just make her bite him? I could, but Brimstone wouldn't be happy, as well you know. Bane is one of his most valued traitors.
Karu sighed. I know. For longer than she had even been alive, Bane had been supplying Brimstone with bear teeth, grizzly, black, and polar, and lynx, fox, mountain lion, wolf, and sometimes even dog. He specialized in predators, always of premium value down here. They were also, Karu had pointed out to Brimstone on many occasions, of premium value to the world. How many beautiful carcasses did that pile of teeth amount to? She watched, dismayed, as Brimstone took two large gold medallions out of his strongbox, each the size of a saucer and engraved with his own likeness. Gavriel's. Enough to buy her flight and invisibility, and he pushed them across the desk to the hunter. Karu scowled as Bane pocketed them and rose from his chair, moving slowly so as not to irritate Avagoth. Out of the corner of one soulless eye, he cut Karu a look that she could almost swear was a gloat, and then had the gall to wink. Karu clenched her teeth and said nothing as Issa escorted Bane out. Had it been only that morning that Kaz had winked at her from the model stand? What a day. The door closed, and Brimstone gestured Karu forward. She heaved the canvas-wrapped tusks toward him and let the bundle collapse on the shop floor.
Be careful, he barked. Do you know the value of these?
Indeed I do, since I just paid it.
That's the human value. The idiots would carve them to bits to make trinkets and baubles.
And what will you do with them? Asked Karu. She kept her voice casual, as if Brimstone might forget himself and reveal at last the mystery at the core of everything. What in the hell he did with all these teeth? He only gave her a weary look, as if to say, nice try. What? You brought it up. And no, I don't know the inhuman value of tusks. I have no idea.
Beyond price.
He started sawing at the duct tape with a curved knife. It's a good thing I had some scuppies on me then, said Karu, flopping into the chair Bane had just vacated. Otherwise, you would have lost your priceless tusks to another bidder.
What?
You didn't give me enough money. This little bastard war criminal kept bidding them up and, well, I'm not sure he was a war criminal, but he had this certain indefinable war criminaliness about him. And I could see he was determined to get them, so maybe I shouldn't have, though, since you don't approve of my pettiness, did you call it? She smiled sweetly and dangled the remaining beads of her necklace. It was more of a bracelet now. She'd used her new itch trick on the man, wishing a relentless onslaught of cranny itches on him until he fled the room. Surely Brimstone knew. He always knew. It would be nice, she thought, if he would say thank you. Instead, he just slapped a coin onto the table. A measly shing. That's it? I dragged those things across Paris for you for a shing, while Beardy gets away with double Gavriel's? Brimstone ignored her and extricated the tusks from their shroud. Twiga came to consult with him, and they muttered in undertones in their own language, which Karu had learned from the cradle in the natural way, and not by wish. It was a harsh tongue, growlsome and full of fricatives, with much of it rising from the throat. By comparison, even German or Hebrew seemed melodious. While they talked about tooth configurations, Karu helped herself to the scuppy teacups and set about replenishing her string of nearly useless wishes, which she decided to keep as a multi-strand bracelet for now. Twiga hauled the tusks over to his corner for cleaning, and Karu contemplated going home. Home. The word always had air quotes around it in her mind. She'd done what she could to make her flat cozy, filling it with art, books, ornate lanterns, and a Persian carpet as soft as lynx fur, and of course there were her angel wings taking up one whole wall. But there was no help for its real emptiness. Its close air was stirred by no breath but her own. When she was alone, the empty place within her, the missingness, as she thought of it, seemed to swell. Even being with Kaz had done something to keep it at bay, though not enough. Never enough. She thought of the little cot that used to be hers, tucked behind the tall bookcases in the back of the shop, and wished whimsically that she could stay here tonight. She could fall asleep, like she used to the sound of murmured voices. Issa's soft slither, the scritch of wee else-thing beasties scampering in the shadows.
Sweet girl!
Yasri bustled out of the kitchen with a tea tray. Beside the teapot was a plate of custard-filled pastries in the shape of horns that were her specialty.
You must be hungry,
she said in her parrot voice. With a sideward glance at Brimstone, she added,
It's not healthy for a growing girl, always running off hither and thither, and not at a moment's notice.
That's me, hither and thither, girl, said Karu. She grabbed a pastry and slumped in her chair to eat it. Brimstone spared her a glance, then said to Yasri,
And I suppose it's healthy for a growing girl to live on pastry,
Yasri tutted.
I'd be happy to fix her a proper meal if you ever gave me warning, you great brute.
She turned to Karu.
You're too thin, lovely. It isn't becoming.
Agreed Issa, caressing Karu's hair.
She should be leopard, don't you think? Sleek and lazy, fur hot from the sun and not too lean. A well-fed leopard girl, lapping from a bowl of cream.
Karu smiled and ate. Yasri poured tea for them all, just how they liked it, which meant four sugars for Brimstone. After all these years, Karu still thought it was funny that the wishmonger had a sweet tooth. She watched as he bent to his never-ending work, stringing teeth into necklaces. Oryx Lacoryx, she identified as he selected a tooth from his tray. He was unimpressed.
Antelopes are child's play.
Give me a hard one, then. He handed her a shark's tooth, and Karu was reminded of the hours she'd sat here with him as a child, learning teeth. Mako, she said.
Long fin or short fin?
She went still, holding the tooth between her thumb and forefinger. Brimstone had trained her in this art since she was small, and she could read the origin and integrity of teeth from their subtle vibrations. She declared, Short. He grunted, which was about as close as he came to praise. Did you know, Karu asked him, that Mako shark fetuses eat each other in the womb? Issa, who was stroking Avagath, gave a of disgust. It's true. Only cannibal fetuses survive to be born. Can you imagine if people were like that? She put her feet up on the desk and 2 seconds later, at a dark look from Brimstone, took them down again. The shop's warmth was making her drowsy. The cot in its little nook called to her, as did the quilt Yasri had made her, so soft from years of snuggling. Brimstone, she said, hesitant. Do you think... At that moment,
A thudding sounded. Violent.
Oh, dear, said Yasri, clicking her beak in agitation as she gathered up the tea things.
It was the shop's other door. Back behind Twiga's workspace, in the shadowed reaches of the shop where no lantern ever hung, there was a second door. In all Karoo's life, it had never been opened in her presence. She had no idea what was behind it.
The thudding came again, so hard it rattled the teeth in their jars.
Brimstone rose, and Karoo knew what was expected of her, that she rise too and leave at once. But she slouched down in her chair.
Let me stay, she said. I'll be quiet. I'll go back to my cot. I won't look.
Karoo, said Brimstone. You know the rules.
I hate rules.
He took a step toward her, prepared to help her out of the chair if she didn't obey, and she shot to her feet, hands up in surrender.
Okay, okay.
She put on her coat as the banging continued, and grabbed another pastry from Yasri's tray before letting Issa usher her into the vestibule. The door closed behind them, sealing out sound. She didn't bother asking Issa who was at the other door. Issa never gave away Brimstone's secrets. But she said, a little pitifully,
I was just about to ask Brimstone if I could sleep in my old cot.
Issa leaned forward to kiss her cheek and said,
Oh, sweet girl, wouldn't that be nice? We can wait right here, the way we did when you were small.
Ah, yes. When Karoo was too small to shove out into the world's streets on her own, Issa had kept her here. Hours they had sometimes crouched in this tiny space, Issa trying to keep her entertained by singing songs or drawing. In fact, it was Issa who had started her drawing, or crowning her with venomous snakes, while inside Brimstone confronted whatever lurked on the other side of that door.
You can come back in, Issa continued. After.
That's okay, Karoo said with a sigh. I'll just go.
Issa squeezed her arm and said,
Sweet dreams, sweet girl.
And Karoo hunched her shoulders and stepped back out into the cold. As she walked, clock towers across Prague started arguing midnight, and the long, fraught Monday came at last to a close. Chapter 9. The Devil's Doorways. Akiva stood at the edge of a rooftop terrace in Riyadh, peering down at a doorway in the lane below. It was as nondescript as the others, but he knew it for what it was. He could feel its bitter aura of magic as an ache behind his eyes. It was one of the devil's portals into the human world. Spreading vast wings that were visible only in his shadow, he glided down to it, landing in a rain of sparks. A street sweeper saw him and dropped to his knees. But Akiva ignored him and faced the door, his grip tightening on the hilt of his sword. He wanted nothing so much as to draw his blade and storm inside, end things quick, right there in Brimstone's shop, end them bloody. But the magic of the portals was cunning, and he knew better than to attempt it. So he did what he had come here to do. He reached out and laid his hand flat against the door. There was a soft glow, and a smell of scorching, and when he took away his hand, its print was scored into the wood. That was all. For now. He turned and walked away, and folk cringed close to walls to let him pass. Certainly they couldn't see him as he truly was. His fiery wings were glamored invisible, and he should have been able to pass as human, but he wasn't quite pulling it off. What people saw was a tall young man, beautiful, truly breath-stealingly beautiful, in a way one rarely beholds in real life, who moved among them with predatory grace, seeming no more mindful of them than if they were statuary in a garden of gods. At his side hung a sword, and his sleeves were pushed up over forearms, tanned and corded with muscle. His hands were a curiosity, etched both white with scars and black with the ink of tattoos. Simple repeating black lines hatched across the tops of his fingers. His dark hair was cropped close to his skull, with a hairline that dipped into a widow's peak. His golden skin was bronzed, darker across the planes of his face. High ridges of cheekbones, brow, bridge of the nose, as if he lived his life in drenching rich honey light. Beautiful as he was forbidding. It was difficult to imagine him breaking into a smile, which indeed Akiva hadn't done in many years, and couldn't imagine doing ever again. But all of this was just fleeting impression. What people fixed on, stopping to watch him pass, were his eyes. They were amber like a tiger's, and like a tiger's they were rimmed in black. The black both of heavy lashes and of kohl, which focused the gold of his irises like beams of light. They were pure and luminous, mesmerizing, and achingly beautiful. But something was wrong, was missing. Humanity, perhaps, that quality of benevolence that humans have without irony, named after themselves. When coming around a corner, an old woman found herself in his path, the full force of his gaze fell on her, and she gasped. There was live fire in his eyes. She was sure he would set her alight. She gasped and stumbled, and he reached out a hand to steady her. She felt heat, and when he continued past, his unseen wings brushed against her. Sparks shivered from them, and she was left gaping in breathless, paralyzed panic at his receding form. Plainly, she saw his shadow wings fan open, and then, with a gust of heat that blew her headscarf off, he was gone. In moments, Akiva was up in the ether, scarcely feeling the sting of ice crystals in the thin air. He let his glamour fall away, and his wings were like sheets of fire sweeping the black of the heavens. He moved at speed onward toward another human city to find another doorway, bitter with the devil's magic, and after that another, until all bore the black handprint. In far reaches of the world, Hazael and Liraz were doing the same. Once all the doors were marked, the end would begin. And it would begin with fire. Chapter 10. Hither and Thither Girl. In general, Karu managed to keep her two lives in balance. On the one hand, she was a 17-year-old art student in Prague. On the other, errand girl to an inhuman creature who was the closest thing she had to family. For the most part, she'd found that there was time enough in a week for both lives. If not every week, at least most. This did not turn out to be one of those weeks. Tuesday, she was still in class when Kishmish alighted on the window ledge and rapped at the glass with his beak. His note was even more succinct than yesterday's and read only, "Come." Karu did, though if she'd known where Brimstone was sending her, she might not have. The animal market in Saigon was one of her least favorite places in the world. The caged kittens and German shepherds, the bats and sun bears and langur monkeys were not sold as pets, but food. An old crone of a butcher's mother saved teeth in a funerary urn, and it was Karu who had to collect them every few months and seal the deal with a sour swig of rice wine that left her stomach churning. Wednesday, Northern Canada. Two Athabascan hunters, a sickening howl of wolf teeth. Thursday, San Francisco. A young blonde herpetologist with a cache of rattlesnake fangs left over from her unfortunate research subjects. "You know, you could come into the shop yourself," Karu told her, irritated because she had a self-portrait due the next day and could have used the extra hours to perfect it. There were various reasons why traders might not come into the shop. Some had lost the privilege through misbehavior. Others weren't yet vetted. Many were simply afraid to submit to the serpent collars, which shouldn't have been a problem in this case since this particular scientist spent her days with snakes by choice. The herpetologist shuddered. "I came once. I thought the snake woman was going to kill me." Karu smothered a smile. "Ah,
She understood. Issa was no friend to reptile killers, and had been known to coax her snakes into semi-strangulation as the mood arose.
Well, okay.
She counted out 20s into a decent stack. But you know, if you do come in, Brimstone will pay you wishes worth much more than this. He did not, to Carew's bitterness, entrust her to dispense wishes on his behalf.
Maybe next time.
Your choice. Carew shrugged and left with a little wave to head back to the portal and through it, taking note, as she did, that a black handprint was scorched into its surface. She was going to mention it to Brimstone, but he was with a trader and she had homework to get to, so she went on her way. Up half the night working on her self-portrait, she was groggy on Friday and hopeful that Brimstone wouldn't summon her again. He usually didn't send for her more than twice a week, and it had already been 4 times. In the morning, while drawing old Wictor in nothing but a feather boa, a sight Zuzana almost did not survive, she kept an eye on the window. All through afternoon painting studio, she kept fearing that Kishmish would appear. But he didn't, and after school she waited for Zuzana under a ledge out of the drizzle.
Well, said her friend, it's a Carew.
Get a good look, folks. Sightings of this elusive creature are getting rarer all the time.
Carew noted the coolness in her voice. Poison? She suggested hopefully. After the week she'd had, she wanted to go to the cafe and sink into a couch, gossip and laugh, and sketch and drink tea and make up for lost normal. Zuzana gave her the eyebrow.
What, no errands?
No, thank God. Come on, I'm freezing.
I don't know, Carew. Maybe I have secret errands today.
Carew chewed the inside of her cheek and wondered what to say. She hated the way Brimstone kept secrets from her, and she hated even more having to do the same thing to Zuzana. What kind of friendship was based on evasions and lies? Growing up, she'd found it almost impossible to have friends. The need for lies always got in the way. It had been even worse then, because she'd lived in the shop. Forget about having a friend over to play. She would exit the portal in Manhattan each morning for school, followed by her lessons in karate and aikido, and go back to it each evening. It was a boarded-up door of an abandoned building in the East Village, and when Carew was in 5th grade, a friend named Belinda had seen her go in and had come to the conclusion that she was homeless. Word got around. Parents and teachers got involved, and Carew, unable to produce Esther, her fake grandmother on short notice, was taken into DHS custody. She was put into a group home, from which she escaped the first night, never to be seen again. After that, a new school in Hong Kong, an extra caution that no one saw her using the portal. That meant more lies and secrecy, and no possibility of real friends. She was old enough now that there was no risk of social services sniffing around. But as for friends, that was still a tightrope. Zuzana was the best friend she'd ever had, and she didn't want to lose her. She sighed. I'm sorry about this week. It's been crazy. It's work.
Work. Since when do you work?
I work. What do you think I live on, rainwater and daydreams?
She'd hoped to make Zuzana smile, but her friend just squinted at her.
How would I know what you live on, Carew? How long have we been friends, and you've never mentioned a job or a family or anything?
Ignoring the family or anything part, Carew replied,
Well, it's not exactly a job. I run errands for this guy, make pickups, meet with people.
What, like a drug dealer?
Come on, Zeus, really? He's a collector, I guess.
Oh? What does he collect?
Just stuff. Who cares?
I care. I'm interested. It just sounds weird, Carew. You're not mixed up in something weird, are you?
Oh, no, thought Carew. Not at all. Taking a deep breath, she said,
I really can't talk about it. It's not my business. It's his.
Fine. Whatever.
Zuzana spun on one platform heel and walked out into the rain.
Wait!
Carew called after her. She wanted to talk about it. She wanted to tell Zuzana everything, to complain about her crappy week, the elephant tusks, the nightmarish animal market, how Brimstone only paid her in stupid shings, and the creepy banging on the other door. She could put it in her sketchbook, and that was something, but it wasn't enough. She wanted to talk. It was out of the question, of course. "Can we please go to Poison?" she asked, her voice coming out small and tired. Zuzana looked back and saw the expression that Karu sometimes got when she thought no one was watching. It was sadness. Lostness. And the worst thing about it was the way it seemed like a default. Like it was there all the time. And all her other expressions were just an array of masks she used to cover it up. Zuzana relented. "Fine. Okay. I'm dying for some goulash. Get it? Dying." The poisoned goulash. It was an old groaner between them, and Karu knew everything was okay. For now. But what about next time? They set out umbrella-less and huddled together, hurrying through the drizzle. "You should know," Zuzana said. "Jackass has been hanging around Poison. I think he's lying in wait for you." Karu groaned. Great. Kaz had been calling and texting, and she had been ignoring him. "We could go somewhere else." "No, I'm not letting that rodent loaf have Poison. Poison's ours."
"Rodent loaf?" repeated Zuzana.
It was a favorite insult of Issa's, and made sense in the context of the serpent woman's diet, which consisted mainly of small furry creatures. Karu said, "Yes, loaf of rodent, ground mouse meat with breadcrumbs and ketchup."
"Ugh, stop."
"Or you could substitute hamsters, I suppose," said Karu. "Or guinea pigs. You know they roast guinea pigs in Peru, skewered on little sticks like marshmallows?"
"Stop,"
said Zuzana.
Guinea pig s'mores.
Stop now, before I throw up, please." And Karu did stop. Not because of Zuzana's plea, but because she caught a familiar flutter in the corner of her eye.
"No, no, no,"
she said to herself. She didn't, wouldn't, turn her head. "Not Kishmish, not tonight." Noting her sudden silence, Zuzana asked,
"You okay?"
The flutter again, in a circle of lamplight in Karu's line of sight. Too far off to draw special attention to itself, but unmistakably Kishmish.
"Damn."
"I'm fine," Karu said, and she kept on resolutely in the direction of Poison Kitchen. What was she supposed to do? Smack her forehead and claim to have remembered an errand? After all that? She wondered what Zuzana would say if she could see Brimstone's little beast messenger, his bat wings so bizarre on his feathered body. Being Zuzana, she'd probably want to make a marionette version of him. "How's the puppet project coming?" Karu asked, trying to act normal. Zuzana brightened and started to tell her. Karu half-listened, but she was distracted by her jumbled defiance and anxiety. What would Brimstone do if she didn't come? What could he do? Come out and get her? She was aware of Kishmish following, and as she ducked under the arch into the courtyard of Poison Kitchen, she gave him a pointed look as if to say, "I see you, and I'm not coming." He cocked his head at her, perplexed, and she left him there and went inside. The cafe was crowded, though Kaz, blessedly, was nowhere to be seen. A mix of local laborers, backpackers, expat artist types, and students hung out at the coffins, the fume of their cigarettes so heavy the Roman statues seemed to loom from a fog, ghoulish in their gas masks. "Damn," said Karu, seeing a trio of scruffy backpackers lounging at their favorite table. "Pestilence is taken."
"Everything is taken," said Zuzana. "Stupid lonely planet book. I want to go back in time and mug that damn travel writer at the end of the alley, make sure he never finds this place."
"So violent. You want to mug and tase everybody these days."
"I do," Zuzana agreed. "I swear, I hate more people every day. Everyone annoys me. If I'm like this now, what am I going to be like when I'm old?"
"You'll be the mean old biddy who fires a BB gun at kids from her balcony."
Nah, BBs just rile them up.
More like a crossbow or a bazooka.
You're a brute. Zuzana dropped a curtsy, then took another frustrated look around at the crowded cafe.
Suck. Want to go somewhere else?
Karu shook her head. Their hair was already soaked. She didn't want to go back out. She just wanted her favorite table in her favorite cafe. In her jacket pocket, her fingers toyed with the store of shings from the week's errands. I think those guys are about to leave. She nodded to the backpackers at Pestilence.
I don't think so, said Zuzana. They have full beers.
No, I think they are. Between Karu's fingers, one of the shings dematerialized. A second later, the backpackers rose to their feet. Told you. In her head, she fancied she heard Brimstone's commentary. Evicting strangers from cafe tables. Selfish.
Weird,
was Zuzana's response as the girls slipped behind the giant horse statue to claim their table. Looking bewildered, the backpackers left.
They were kind of cute, said Zuzana.
Oh, you want to call them back?
As if.
They had a rule against backpacker boys, who blew through with the wind and started to all look the same after a while, with their stubbly chins and wrinkled shirts.
I was simply making a diagnosis of cuteness. Plus, they looked kind of lost, like puppies.
Karu felt a pang of guilt. What was she doing, defying Brimstone, spending wishes on mean things like forcing innocent backpackers out into the rain? She flopped onto the couch. Her head ached. Her hair was clammy, she was tired, and she couldn't stop worrying about the wishmonger. What would he say? The entire time she and Zuzana were eating their goulash, her gaze kept straying to the door.
Watching for someone? Zuzana asked.
Oh, just afraid Kaz might turn up.
Yeah, well, if he does, we can wrestle him into this coffin and nail it shut.
Sounds good. They ordered tea, which came in an antique silver service, the sugar and creamer dishes engraved with the words arsenic and strychnine. So, said Karu, you'll see Violin Boy tomorrow at the theater. What's your strategy?
I have no strategy, said Zuzana. I just want to skip all this and get to the part where he's my boyfriend. Not to mention, you know, the part where he's aware I exist.
Come on, you wouldn't really want to skip this part.
Yes, I would.
Skip meeting him? The butterflies, the pounding heart, the blushing? The part where you enter each other's magnetic fields for the first time, and it's like invisible lines of energy are drawing you together.
Invisible lines of energy? Zuzana repeated. Are you turning into one of those New Age weirdos who wears crystals and reads people's auras?
You know what I mean. First date, holding hands, first kiss, all the smoldering and yearning.
Oh, Karu, you poor little romantic.
Hardly. I was going to say the beginning is the good part, when it's all sparks and sparkles, before they are inevitably unmasked as assholes.
Zuzana grimaced. They can't all be assholes, can they?
I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe just the pretty ones.
But he is pretty. God, I hope he's not an asshole. Do you think there's any chance he's both a non-orifice and single? I mean, seriously, what are the chances?
Slim.
I know.
Zuzana slumped dramatically back and lay crumpled like a discarded marionette. Pavel likes you, you know, said Karu. He's a certified non-orifice.
Yes, well, Pavel is sweet, but he does not give of the butterflies.
The butterflies in the belly, Karu sighed. I know. You know what I think? I think the butterflies are always there in your belly, in everyone, all the time.
Like bacteria?
No, not like bacteria, like butterflies. And some people's butterflies react to other people's on a chemical level, like pheromones, so that when they're nearby, your butterflies start to dance. They can't help it. It's chemical.
Chemical. Now that's romantic.
I know, right? Stupid butterflies. Liking the idea, Karu opened her sketchbook and started to draw it. cartoon intestines, and a stomach crowded with butterflies. Papilio stomachus would be their Latin name. Zuzana asked,
"So, if it's all chemical and you have no say in the matter, does that mean Jackass still makes your butter?"